from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the MBTA gets a new GM, private sector turnaround specialist Luis Ramirez.
Luis knows how to diagnose problems. He knows how to identify fixes. He knows how to communicate and work with stakeholders, managers, and employees and get things done.
Plus,
we reject hatred, and we will do every single thing in our power to keep hate out of our city.
Why Mayor Marty Walsh's stance on a potential right-wing rally in Boston has civil libertarians on the left alarmed. Plus, historian Nathaniel Philbrick on his new children's book about the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Boston suddenly became this American-wide focal point where 13 colonies that never before really had been on the same page were beginning to think of themselves as sharing in one colony's destiny.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we have a verdict in the Top Chef extortion trial. Not guilty. The four defendants were found not guilty on all federal counts of conspiracy and trying to extort jobs from the host and crew of the television show Top Chef. The Teamsters had been accused of threatening the crew into hiring union workers. Now, lawyers for the defendants didn't actually put any of their own witnesses on the stand, so how did we come out with that not guilty finding? WBUR senior reporter David Bowery was in the courtroom today, and he joins us now. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So give us the reaction in the courtroom when this not guilty verdict was announced.
Judge Douglas Woodlock was handed the verdicts. He took a read of those verdicts. His face seemed to portray a grimace. There were four defendants, each charged two counts of conspiracy and attempt to extort. And then came the reads. Not guilty eight times. Prosecutors grim-faced, a look of relief on the defendants followed by bear hugs and back slaps with their attorneys. And it was a resounding setback to the prosecutors and stunning to those who'd focused on the alleged behavior in 2014 of when the Top Chef came to town. It was stunning.
Yeah. You know, and it's stunning in light of what we heard in testimony from some of the star witnesses in this case. You know, just to remind folks, Padma Lakshmi saying like she had been directly threatened with violence even. So I guess a lot of people are wondering how this acquittal happened.
Well, the attorneys were worried that the jury was going to be driven by emotion because they saw all the attention went to that video and the talk of witnesses and those accounts describing certainly behavior that was vile, thuggish. There's not a question that it was thuggish. These guys were not members of the welcome wagon, and they're not on the Chamber of Commerce, and they're still not going to be on that. But the lawyers said that the federal prosecutors essentially were criminalizing union activity. Here's Carmen Lepore, one of the defense attorneys.
We've always felt this prosecution was misplaced. Goes without saying, we're glad that the jury saw this case for what it was.
And David,
and
what it was.
Yeah, what it was.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what it was. It clearly was. It was vile stuff. However, what the jury was looking at, what the lawyers wanted the jury to look at, was a whole body of law, including a Supreme Court opinion going back to 1970, that recognizes and protects legitimate union activity. And that's the key. Even if violence is used in the pursuit of legitimate union protests, or actions seeking higher wages and jobs, it's not covered by the Hobbs Act, which is the Anti-Racketeering Act going back to the 1950s. Is it subject to criminal prosecution? Yes, the court ruled in state courts, but the federal law does not cover it. That's what the opinion was going back to the Supreme Court, and that's what the lawyers argued here. Here's Oscar Cruz.
I think that they focused a little too much on the picket line conduct and tried to distract the jury from what the real issue was in this case, which is the goal. And the goal was real jobs.
real jobs. And so what it came down to, you know, what it came down to was this idea. Were those jobs, and it narrowed down in the frame of the trial, were the jobs that they were supposedly seeking, were they additional services or were they replacement services? And the reason that's important is because the court had ruled, the federal court, the high court had ruled that if jobs are payoffs, if they're fictitious jobs, if they're unwanted jobs, that's illegitimate union activity. But if they're replacement jobs, meaning if they drop people who are non-union and replace them with union, that would be a legitimate, and that's not extortion.
Mm-hmm.
The government still has to prove its case. They still have to prove their point and produce evidence. According to the attorneys, they did not produce that. And so you have the benefit of the doubt, and that goes to the defendants, and that's why we have the verdict.
Okay, interesting analysis there, David. So what kind of precedent do you think this sets then?
Well, this is a continuation, and it's important. It's a continuation, lawyers would say, of the protection for union activity, legitimate union activity, and seeking jobs. That's the finding they would say occurs here. These guys are going to go back to work. Meanwhile, in the background, there's an appeals court case in this court where two Teamsters who were convicted back in 2014 have appealed their court. It goes to the same nature. Are these extortionate acts or not? Legitimate union activity or not? That's playing out, and we haven't heard the answer to that. And that may have a bearing on what else is to come in the city of Boston, including actions involving perhaps other Teamsters in other places, just like we are in front of a couple of trials of staffers of the mayor, who have been charged essentially with extortion by threatening companies that unless they hire union work, they're not going to get permits.
Yeah, good point there. Okay, so what do you think, though, that this case says about the future of TV shows, movies, any kind of production that wants to film in Boston? Because the city's been getting a lot of bad press because of this case.
We are a union town. We're a town with Teamsters. And those Teamsters can get tough, and this ruling today says, yeah, they may get tough, they may be vile, they may make threats to smash pretty little faces in. If that happens, that's the subject of criminal prosecution by the state courts, not by the federal courts. Otherwise, this is legitimate. If it's legitimate activity, it will not be covered by federal law. By the way, I should point out that those disappointed federal prosecutors today, and they were devastated by this, released a statement through the acting U.S. attorney, William Weinreb. He says, we're disappointed in today's verdict. We will continue to aggressively prosecute extortion in all its forms to ensure that Boston remains a safe and welcoming place to do business.
Okay. So one last question for you, David. I understand that the judge in this case is actually keeping the jurors' identities sealed until at least Thursday at noon. He told the press that a degree of respect and recognition of boundaries is appropriate.
So we have a stake in this because WBUR has filed the motion, which has prompted the judge to say he will release the jurors' list on Thursday. We would like it sooner. But, yeah, the judge says that typically he believes that the jurors need a couple of days to decompress from trials before they are exposed to reporters. He is better in this than other federal judges in this courthouse who have held the list for unconscionably long times in this reporter's opinion. Jurors have been likened in federal rulings to being citizen soldiers. They're doing their duty, but just like soldiers, sometimes their duties are unpleasant. That might involve dealing with people like us, but they can exercise their First Amendment rights and tell us to go fly a kite.
Well, that's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri bringing us up to speed on those not guilty verdicts in the Top Chef case. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Magna.
Let's move on to the MBTA because the transit provider has named a new general manager.
We're going to double down on what we've already done in terms of fiscal responsibility. and we're going to continue making the right investments to make the T the world-class organization needs to be.
Well, that is Luis Ramirez. He will take over the transit system next month, and interestingly, he actually has no experience in either transportation nor the public sector. Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney was there for the announcement of the new MBTA GM, and she's with us now. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so who is Luis Ramirez?
So this is his first public sector job, and he comes to it with a lot of corporate experience. He worked for 11 years at Siemens, starting as a systems analyst and working his way up. Then he worked for GE for 12 years, rising through the ranks. The last position he held was GE's Energy Industrial Solutions business, leading that component of GE. He said it had 17,000 employees and $3.5 billion in annual revenue. Then he went on to lead a Texas engineering and manufacturing company called Global Power Equipment Group. He says he brought in new leadership and turned that company around, and then went into starting his own consulting company focusing on turnarounds. And in a lot of ways, this resume of this corporate experience, turnarounds, is not that much of a surprise. Governor Baker had said back in May that he wanted a turnaround CEO. And here's what Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack said earlier today.
In fact, transit expert was not high on our priority list when we launched the search for a new general manager 6 months ago. What we wanted was a successful and a seasoned executive with a proven track record at leading complex organizations through transformation and change.
Mm-hmm.
So a moment of change for the T in the direction that the governor wants to push it in. But it also has been a moment of change for the T in terms of leadership. As Secretary Pollack noted, that in her 30 months as transportation secretary, there have been four general managers. So the hope is to provide more long-term stability. And Ramirez says he's hoping to stay till the job is done.
Which could be forever, right, for the T. But okay, so point taken, the point that the Secretary Pollack in that tape was making taken. But, you know, as you know, we've been talking about the T on this show forever. And I have to say my ears perk up when I hear the secretary say that transit expert was not high on our priority list when they launched the search for this new GM. Because I immediately wonder, you know, it seems like there are different skills and two different worlds between private sector turnaround versus running a big public sector organization, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, what you think about this, his background depends on where you stand. I mean, maybe it is time for a change of perspective. We haven't had this perspective really infused in a long-term permanent GM position. So maybe there a fresh set of eyes can think outside the box and make the changes that are needed. Definitely has the support of the governor and a plan behind it. But there definitely are unique challenges for transit that maybe the business acumen may not directly or easily transfer into, like dealing with unions or just the complexity of running a system like this.
Mm-hmm.
Ramirez says his first priority, knowing that he's new to this, is to talk to people, talk to the riders, talk to workers, talk to stakeholders. But he also noted that while the T is headed in the right direction financially, he feels, there's still a lot of work to be done.
We have a lot of room for improvement. And I think that the work that the people have already started here in the last 2 years is great.
So it's a lot of positivity, but it is a really tough public job, and it's chewed up a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. But we will allow for optimism on a person's first day at
yeah,
work.
I'll give him a break. Yeah. I'll give him a break. You
exactly.
know, ask me in 6 months.
Then the team will beat him down by then, we're sure. Okay, no. Back to seriousness here. I mean, so Kathleen, as you and I have been talking about all day, I mean, I feel like there are many clear ways in the private sector to measure turnaround success. Revenue generation, cost cutting, return to shareholder value, etc. Did Luis Ramirez today say the metrics that he might use to measure success at the T?
Well, I mean, as we said, it is his first day on the job. So, you know, he said he's going to sort all of that out. Really, what he wants is a world-class transportation system, and he wants to build on the work that's underway. And as we heard, double down on the fiscal responsibility and continue to make investments in the T.
Okay. And those investments are much needed because I can't believe it's already been 2 years because I still feel traumatized from the winter of
right.
20, whatever it was, to 2 years ago. So
2015,
we need a lot of changes.
The winter that shall not be named. Yeah. I mean, how can you forget it? 108 inches, record-breaking snow up to, I mean, that's like as high as I am. you know, the entire system shut down for 2 full days. And it
just
took
for
weeks.
The record, you are not 180 inches tall.
All right. So that's not my strong suit is height. Okay. Anyway. But, you know, the general manager, Beverly Scott, resigned as a result of the breakdowns in the system. And Governor Baker really made the MBTA a cornerstone for him. And he created the Fiscal Control Board to try to get the finances back on track. The legislature approved changes to make it easier to privatize some parts of the T. And Governor Baker added more money just on winterization projects alone, mm-hmm. over $100 million. So Ramirez, you know, says that he's going to keep building on that momentum.
Since the winter of 2015, there's been a clear political will to fix the MBTA. The dollars to make those physical improvements are there, and we must do a better job getting them through the door.
Okay, Kathleen, I have to say, when I hear someone say the dollars to make improvements at the T are there, that's debatable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear the Baker administration has put investments. I talked to a couple of people. Rafael Meres of the Conservation Law Foundation said that what Ramirez might be referencing is capital investments, that mm-hmm. basically the Fiscal Control Board has created a kind of a lockbox to hold money for capital investments until they feel that they're better positioned. So there is some money that's just sitting there on the table that needs to be put out.
But of course, that's completely separate from operating.
Right.
Yeah, which
and
is problematic with
Meres
the
city. And yeah. Former Transportation Secretary Jim Aloisi, you know, said that there is this problem of needing more revenues to just run the T. Here's Aloisi.
Those of us who pay a lot of attention to transit in Greater Boston know pretty clearly that there's not enough net new revenue to both improve the service, deal with state of good repair, and provide people with the strategic expansions of the system that we need to support our economy. We know that.
So, you know, I mean, Aloisi said, still, the guy's not even technically in the job yet. We'll wait and see. It's just good to point out that he and other advocates really feel that there need to be some more resources put into the system.
Now, a while ago when the search was going on, state officials had said they would consider increasing the compensation for the MBTA general manager in order to attract top talent. Did that happen with Ramirez?
It did. I mean, not in order to be competitive, this contract that they've signed with Ramirez is a 3-year contract for $320,000.
A year? $320,000 a year?
$320,000 a year, yep. And there's also an opportunity built in for performance-based bonuses. They're still hammering out the details of what those metrics will be and what the bonus will look like, and say they'll have that in place by the time he starts on September 12th.
September 12th, okay. Well, that's Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney bringing us the news on Luis Ramirez. He today was named the new head of the MBTA. Kathleen, 108 inches tall McNerney.
Thank I'm never going to live that down.
You're a giant in my eyes, no matter what. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So let's talk a little bit more about that planned free speech rally on Boston Common on Saturday. It's organized by a group that calls itself the New Free Speech Movement, and they say they're not affiliated with the white nationalists who organized the rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia, that ended in that terrible violence. But the bill of speakers at the Boston event did include some of the same people who were at Charlottesville. Now, we should note that the list of speakers is actually shrinking. At least 3 people are no longer coming or have been uninvited by the group, including Augustus Invictus, a former Florida state Senate candidate who advocates something akin to a second American Civil War. He was uninvited yesterday, according to the Boston Globe. Now, all of this happened around the same time as a press conference held yesterday by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and others. And in this press conference, the mayor said the following.
We are a city that believes in free speech, but we will not tolerate incitements to violence. We will not tolerate threatening behavior. We will not have it.
So on the one hand, we've got the language of extremism and hate cloaked in the garb of free speech from the far right. And on the other, we've got city officials saying they believe in free speech, but won't tolerate incitement. Well, that's troubling to Harvey Silverglade. He's an attorney who specializes in civil liberties, and he is the author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. Harvey Silverglade, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
It's great to have you. I should note, first and foremost, that we're having this conversation right at the same time that there's a press conference going on at the Holocaust Memorial in Boston, which was terribly vandalized yesterday. So, I mean, these are very tense times in Boston, in greater Boston right now. I mean, what's the problem with the mayor speaking out against hate and violence?
Well, I think the mayor is acting like a lot of mayors do. He would like things as quiet on his watch and as peaceful on his watch as possible. Free speech, when it's really robust, can be a real pain in the neck. Same for the police, you know. It's much easier if you keep the speakers out of town rather than have to keep the peace at the Boston Common or wherever else. So the mayor is acting in his most basic expected role, but not the role that the society really demands of political figures, to protect the civil liberties of everybody, and that includes the people who want to speak.
Well, but, I mean, Harvey, to be clear, like, the mayor didn't say, you cannot come. I mean, he did acknowledge that Boston embraces free speech, and so if they wanted to come, they can. The mayor's not saying, we won't give you a permit.
It was a real mixed message, and mixed messages are kind of dangerous. He'd be much better off, and I think the situation would be much clearer and calmer, if instead of the saying, well, we'll give you a permit, but you should understand you're not welcome here. That's giving a mixed message. The mixed message is you really shouldn't show up. And that is not a responsible position for the mayor to take.
Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I'm not quite sure who the devil is in this case, but I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say, what if it is the responsibility of the mayor right now? Because, again, he clearly said he supports free speech. But as we saw in Charlottesville, we have a group, maybe a loosely affiliated, maybe not group, but the potential for violence to come to Boston. And if his duty is to protect the city as well, isn't he doing the right thing by saying that won't be tolerated?
Well, you know, I don't think he's doing the right thing. Boston has had a series of these kinds of events. You may be old enough to remember the St. Patrick's Day parade case, in which the state courts refused to allow the Irish war veterans to have their parade unless they made it inclusive of the gay servicemen. And the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously reversed that, saying, no, you can't do that. The veterans are entitled to have their own event, and then an hour later, the gay vets can march. Everybody has their opportunity, even in Boston, and there are no excuses. So we've had a long history of having the federal Supreme Court having to remind us of that. If this case went to the courts, I don't have any doubt that a permit would have to be issued and security would have to be provided. It's just another speech event. Mm. And to make it into, well, you know, it's really a potential riot. Every speech event is a potential riot if the rioters show up, and it's the job of the government to make sure that if the rioters do show up, they don't riot.
Yeah. Well, so just to be clear, I mean, no permit has been issued so far because, from our reporting and the Boston Globe's as well, it's because the group has not applied to the correct city department for the permit. So it's not as if any permit's been withheld actively.
Right. Have they been told where to apply for the permit?
Yes. They were directed to the correct department and just did not follow up or didn't realize that they had to.
Maybe they've been intimidated from all the talk. and that wouldn't be a very healthy situation either. But
this was before. I mean, they were told before Monday and before the weekend.
Yeah. Well, as I said, maybe they're not going to apply for a permit.
Yeah. So, but Harvey, I think, you know, what we're trying to get at here in this, in our exploration is what's the deeper things that are at stake, right? Because I know for a long time you've been looking at college campuses as a place where speech has been tamped down by
speech codes that.
Yeah. And protests against certain speakers and things like that.
Yeah. And those codes would be unconstitutional if they were adopted by the city of Boston. That's why they have not been.
Yeah. So what's at stake here then? I mean, again, I'm sort of debating in my mind, like, you know, was this a good act of leadership for the mayor to say this is a city that who morally will not tolerate, the KKK, anti-Semitism, neo-Nazis, that thing. But legally, you want your permit, you can have it if you just apply for it in the right way.
Well, it's fine for the mayor to get on a soapbox and say, we don't like you, and we don't like what you stand for. However, we are going to protect your right to speak. And if that message is clear, then the mayor has done his duty.
Mm. So, I mean, you have been a long-time free speech advocate. I want to ask you about the flip side of things here. I mean, what is your genuine reaction, your feeling? Do you have any concern that we have these far right-wing groups now, some of whom are just, you know, free speech absolutists and advocates. Others are whom are using that language actually as an umbrella to protect what their real message is, which is anti-Semitic, racist, white nationalist, white supremacist.
You're going to be a little surprised by my answer, but my answer is that it is actually a public service for these groups to come to Boston and speak. Why do I say that? One of the most important functions of free speech is that we know who it is whom we have to watch out for as we look around. And unless these groups are allowed to speak, we have no idea as to the nature and the depth of their hatreds, of their biases, and of any danger that they pose. So free speech is actually a public safety issue as far as I'm concerned.
Mm.
I want to know what these people think. I want to know who they are. And to say they're not welcome to speak in Boston is exactly counterproductive.
Right. And then there is the sort of absolute value, I would say, of protecting the most challenging speech we can so that, A, it doesn't allow the government to pick and choose what it thinks is problematic speech, and, B, so that everyone else is protected. I mean, that's kind of the old reasoning, isn't
it? That's the old reasoning, but I've gone one step ahead in my analysis of it, and I'm saying that it's actually important for public safety to allow people like that to speak so that you know who the dangerous people are, if indeed they're dangerous. I'd like to hear what they have to say. I don't take the government's analysis on faith that these are, quote, alt-right or these are dangerous fascists. I'd like to hear it for myself.
Right. I see your point. I mean, especially in the age of the internet where anonymity can so easily cloak so much of this hate. I mean, it's hard to find out who these people are.
I'd love to have somebody define for me what an alt-right person even is.
Yeah. But Harvey, here's another thing I'd love to get your take on. This is one thing for creating, you know, a climate where speech is tolerated and so we can hear even the most vile speech and identify who that is. But I'll tell you what really worries me even more. It's that, we're living in an age where money equals speech also, and it's next to impossible to find out who's funding these groups. I mean, like, that seems to be a big problem, too.
Well, you know, there are also two sides to that story. The Supreme Court has approved of anonymous money in politics, for example. And there are many cases in which anonymity has been held to be an important part of free speech and free association. I mean, this line of Supreme Court cases actually started with the NAACP down in Alabama, where the state wanted them to register who their members are, and they said, no, it's too dangerous for our members to admit that they're members. And the Supreme Court said, you're right. So anonymity has a very important history. During the Revolutionary period, many of the anti-British tracts, political tracts, were anonymous.
But I mean, we may be living in a time where we've got, you know, very, very wealthy people underwriting the activities of folks who do end up inciting violence.
Yes, but you do sacrifice a certain liberty if you insist that the anonymous people come above the surface. I just want to point out that for every good government initiative like that, you actually can also have some sacrifice of liberty. These are very difficult and subtle questions. And to separate the good guys from the bad guys is often very difficult.
Well, that's Harvey Silverglate. He's an attorney who specializes in civil liberties and is the author of numerous books, including The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. Harvey, it's always great. Thanks so much.
Righto. Sorry it couldn't be simpler.
Life never is. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Americans, liberty or death, join or die. Don't shoot till you see the whites of their enemies' eyes. Well, those words, striking at the heart of the American Revolution, are also at the core of a new book from Nantucket-based historian Nathaniel Philbrick. Philbrick is an award-winning author of many books, including In the Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, Bunker Hill, and Valiant Ambition. But this is his first children's book. It's called Ben's Revolution, Benjamin Russell and the Battle of Bunker Hill. And in it, Philbrick tells the story of a young Benjamin Russell, a 12-year-old print shop apprentice who witnesses seminal events at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And Nathaniel Philbrick now joins us from the studios of Nantucket NPR. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
It's tremendous to have you. So many people love so many of your books for grown-ups, if I can put it that way. Tell us about what inspired writing Ben's Revolution as a children's book.
Yeah, I was working on my book Bunker Hill. And in that, I weave all sorts of different narrative threads. And one of the ones I picked up was this 12-year-old boy named Benjamin Russell, who lived in Boston. His family had been there for years. His father was a good friend of Isaiah Thomas, who was one of the newspaper editors in town. And he and his buddies, on the day of Lexington and Concord, follow the British outside of the city, into Roxbury and ultimately Cambridge, and are caught outside of Boston at the beginning of the Revolution with no way to get back for months.
So this actually happened?
This actually happened, and it just struck me to be an amazing real story. And so I began to think, well, at some point it would be really fun to... I had done books, young adult book versions of In the Heart of the Sea and Mayflower, but had never done one for young kids, and had gotten to know the artist Wendell Miner. He had done the covers of my young adult books, and he's just a wonderful artist. Mm-hmm. And so we collaborated on Ben's Revolution.
Yeah. Well, so before we get into more detail about 12-year-old Benjamin, you're right to mention Wendell Miner, so a very gracious tip of the hat to him, because his illustrations for Ben's Revolution are gorgeous. But so tell us about the adult Benjamin Russell, because he amongst certain circles, he's pretty well known. He went on to have quite a career.
Yeah, he was, I won't say the Rupert Murdoch of New England journalism, but he was one of the premier journalists at a time when New England journalism was really at the forefront of what was going on in America. And so he, from these this incredible childhood experience, would go on to be one of our foremost journalists.
Yeah, you know what I loved about this book is it does something central that really good children's books do, and that is it opens our eyes and it reminds us that, you know, these that every event in human history is witnessed and experienced by many people younger than the age of 40, right? And so there's this particular challenge in terms of trying to get the history in while also trying to get it from the perspective of a child or you know, a tween in this case. How did you do that?
Well, you're absolutely right. But for me, what I loved about Ben's story was the sense of wonder and innocence. He really has no idea what's going on. And in fact, not even the adults knew what was going on. And yet, you know, he was put in scary situations, but he was ultimately actually enjoyed himself. And in the process was one of those making history in Boston in 1775. So it was a really fun project.
Well, I mean, you have this great chapter where he ends up sort of mocking British soldiers by doing a little jig while they're playing Yankee Doodle.
Yeah, and this is based on a real incident. The boys were following British reinforcements out to help the British that had been at Lexington and Concord and were now fighting their way back to Boston, and the boys just follow them out of the city. And remember, this is when Boston was an island. It was a 1.1 square mile island with a thin neck of land connecting it to Roxbury, and these boys follow the British soldiers to Roxbury, and it's in Roxbury where the British soldiers start playing Yankee Doodle, which was meant to mock New Englanders. And so a boy started, and it's Ben Russell starts to mock the Englishmen, saying that they will be the ones that will be dancing to a tune on their way back to Boston.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, Nathaniel Philbrick, if you could actually read a passage from the book Ben's Revolution. I loved chapter 5 in particular. Could you read that for us?
Yeah, chapter 5. It's called Boys' Rights, and here it goes. That January, a storm blew in from the north and blanketed Boston in snow. When classes were over at the Queen Street Riding School, Ben and his friends got their wooden sleds to go coasting down the icy streets of Beacon Hill. They started near the mansion owned by the merchant and patriot leader, John Hancock, pushing their sleds across the rutted snow and ice until they seemed to be flying down the hill. Ben was leading the pack as they rushed down School Street when suddenly his sled slowed down. Ben was outraged to discover that ashes had been spread across the snow and ice to make the street less slippery by the British officer who had moved into a nearby house. With several friends at his side, Ben marched up the steps of the British officer's house and rapped on the door. The officer was soon at the doorway. Ben explained that for years this was the boy's favorite coasting place, and now it was ruined. To Ben's surprise, the officer ordered his servant to pour water over the ashes. Soon the water had frozen to ice, and they were coasting once again. Ben had been taught to believe that the soldiers were in Boston to take away his liberties, but this officer had proven to be an understanding man. Later that night, the British officer told General Gage about his encounter with Ben and his friends. The general gave a weary sigh. "No wonder we are having so much trouble with these Bostonians," he said. "Even the children insist on their rights."
That's Nathaniel Philbrick reading a chapter from his new children's book, Ben's Revolution, Benjamin Russell and the Battle of Bunker Hill. I love the chapter in particular because it does it blends what you were talking about earlier, that innocence in the midst of such tense and historically transformative times. But in the back of the book, you say that this chapter in particular is also based on a letter that a British officer wrote recounting this event?
Yeah, it's a letter written by a resident of Boston to his brother-in-law in Philadelphia. And what this is, an incredible group of letters in which it's almost a journal of what's happening during the occupation of Boston in 1774 and 75. And in it, he recounts how these boys were sledding down Beacon Hill and had this encounter with a British officer. This specific incident we don't know if it was Benjamin Russell, but it certainly could have been, and it seemed it was just too good an incident. It had to be included in the story of Benjamin Russell and Bunker Hill.
Yeah. So in this book, we read how, and again, it's sort of for what, 6, 7, 8 year olds?
Yeah, right yeah. there.
Yeah. yeah. So we read how young Benjamin Russell is separated from his family for many months. He's in Cambridge, and he's even he joins a group of young boys who help build a fort. They dig the dirt to build a fort in Cambridge. It just got me wondering. I mean, what more do we know about what children did do, if anything, in assistance to colonial soldiers during the war?
Well, yeah, boys were actually a big part of the Revolutionary Army. And in fact, there were some as young as 15 years old serving as soldiers in the Continental Army, if you can believe it. It was, particularly as the war went on, there were fewer and fewer adults willing to serve. And so there were people of all types and races in serving in the war, but boys were an active part, and particularly at this stage in the Revolution, where the provincial army, it was not yet the Continental Army, was based primarily in Cambridge, and they were occupying the buildings of Harvard College and other buildings, and the boys were doing the menial tasks surrounding, the occupation of Cambridge and the attempt to get the British out of Boston.
Mm-hmm. Talking to you is reminding me of a while ago, a long time ago, we had a conversation with M.T. Anderson, and he had written a YA novel about the siege of Stalingrad. So another book for young people about a different war. I mean, obviously for an older group of readers. But he and I had talked about how you got to pick the right kind of details for the age group that you're writing for, because, wars are bloody, horrible things full of death and suffering as well. Now, granted, he was writing for older kids, so he could go into quite a bit of detail in his book about the siege of Stalingrad. But the Revolutionary War was full of obviously death and suffering and starvation, which you sort of hint at a little bit here. I mean, how did you handle that for your, 7 and 8 year old audience?
Right. Well, it was a real difficult line. I this is about a battle.
And yeah.
As you said, it's as horrific an experience as anyone can witness. And but this was for a young audience. You don't want to freak the kids out. And yet, I also didn't want to pull so many punches that it sanitized the conflict. And so what I did was they were observers. They were very much focused on Israel Putnam,
mm-hmm.
the sort of jocular general from Connecticut who they were serving under as clerks, helping to feed the soldiers. And so they were focusing on him and cheering him on in the midst of the battle. But so that when I am describing Benjamin watching the battle, I do mention that they're watching British soldiers get mowed down as they charge not once but three times toward the American redoubt, and the feelings he was experiencing, because he had that officer who had helped him when he was sledding. He at one doesn't want one of those dead soldiers to be that officer, and so trying to get at the ambivalence of people experiencing this war, because we think of it as good versus evil, but it was something more than that. These were people who's coming from all different points of view, and so I was trying to do it in a way that the kids got a sense of the conflict, of how scary and disruptive and terrifying it was, but in a way that they could get through the book and not be curled up and seeking counseling.
Towards the end of the book, we sort of very quickly go through that 4-month period where he was separated from his family, and he does get reunited, but young Benjamin Russell does. And in the last couple of seconds that we have, Nathaniel Filbert, can I make a pitch to you?
Sure.
Because I was thinking that in that 4-month period that isn't really explored in detail in this book for young readers, that you have the potential for your next YA book, because I would love to hear more and read more about what happened to Benjamin Russell in those 4 months when he was, essentially working for Israel Putnam in Cambridge and doing his part in the revolution.
Wow. Well, Johnny Tremaine was a big influence in
yeah.
my upbringing,
yeah.
And that has all sorts. That's very interesting. Well, thank you.
Well, that's Nathaniel Philbrick, very graciously listening to my pitch. pretty gutsy thing for me to do to make a pitch to an award-winning author like that. But he is the award-winning author of many books, including In the Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, Bunker Hill, and Valiant Ambition. And we have been talking about his new children's book, which is Ben's Revolution, Benjamin Russell and the Battle of Bunker Hill. Nathaniel Philbrick, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, great to talk to you.
Well, finally today, let's hear about that press conference that just wrapped up at the Holocaust Memorial in downtown Boston. The memorial was terribly vandalized for the second time this summer. That happened yesterday. Police said that last night, a 17-year-old boy from Malden threw a rock through one of the glass panels. Those are those glass panels that are etched with numbers, representing the numbers that were tattooed on the arms of Jews sent to Nazi death camps. The teenager was tackled by two bystanders and held until police arrived. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh responded to the incident today. He had a message that echoed his response to the incidents in Charlottesville over the weekend.
There is no place for hate in Boston. As Bostonians, we stand together in solidarity with our diverse community and our diverse nation. We give that same message today as we pick up the broken pieces of glass and rebuild that panel together.
WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown is at the Holocaust Memorial. And Steve, first of all, what more do we know about the person who police say or believe vandalized the Holocaust Memorial?
Not much more other than it's a juvenile, 17 years old, presumably male from Malden. He was arraigned today in juvenile court because of his age, 17. They did not release his name. We do know that he was released on personal recognizance, told to stay away from this Holocaust memorial here in Boston, and to obtain some mental counseling. Beyond that, we don't know much more.
Mm. Tell us more then about what Mayor Walsh and other attendees at today's press conference had to say. I mean, as we noted earlier, this is the second time the memorial has been vandalized this summer.
That's right. A lot of the folks who are here feel that it's deja vu, that, you know, they were just here not so long ago, about a month ago, when it was vandalized back then. They had a rededication ceremony when the panel that the previous panel that was broken was replaced. They had a rededication ceremony, and they hoped that they'd moved on and that they wouldn't have to do this again. This memorial has been here for around 22 years, and until just recently has never been vandalized. There's no security here other than folks that are walking by, the local police that might be by, but there's no security or anything like that. For 22 years, there were no incidents here at the Holocaust Memorial in Boston, and now within just a short period of time, there are two. And as the mayor had indicated, that there is a climate of hate, but he says we're not going to allow that climate to grow here in Boston. They certainly hope this is the last time that they have to be here at this memorial for this sort of a gathering.
Oh, absolutely. Don't we all? There were Holocaust survivors, I understand, at this press conference as well today. We have some tape from one of them, Israel Arbeiter. His parents and 7-year-old brother were killed at Auschwitz, and he explained how he felt when he first heard news of yesterday's vandalism.
And so yesterday evening, when I heard the news that the memorial has been damaged again for the second time, and we were here only a few weeks ago, of course the pain in me yesterday and today was increased. It hurt. It hurt me because just as if I would have lost a member of my family.
Steve, did officials talk about next steps in terms of repairing the memorial? Do we have a time frame on that?
Not so much. They weren't really talking about the specifics, the mechanics of fixing this. It didn't take all that long to repair it before, so I would imagine it would be a fairly quick turnaround. They want to have this back to its original state, the state that it's intended to be, as soon as possible. But as far as a timeline at this point, I have not heard.
Mm. Now, of course, it's inescapable to think about what happened last night without also thinking about that we're still, the nation is still reeling from the violence in Charlottesville, where white supremacists were marching in Charlottesville with torches saying, we will not be replaced by Jews. I mean, it pains me to even have to quote that. So did any of the speakers talk about that context?
Well, Mayor Walsh was quite concerned, as he was yesterday at yesterday's news conference, talking about this climate of hate that has seemed to have ratcheted up in the last few months. He acknowledged it again today that, you have this memorial vandalized twice within a very short period of time. Is this the new normal? Are we going to be coming down here a lot more frequently because of that? So he did acknowledge that there is some change in attitude in the nation, and that could be having a factor on what's going on here.
That's WBUR Statehouse reporter Steve Brown speaking to us from the Holocaust Memorial in downtown Boston. Steve, thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.